Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chairman of the Humanities Forum. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to welcome Larry Tighe here to speak about his new book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. It's very interesting, I just found out from one of the people here at the Commonwealth Club, that Bobby Kennedy spoke here in this building just 1 week before he died. This is our temporary home, and this is was the press club at the time, and so he spoke to the press corps. And now we have Larry to speak about exactly what the arc of his life was like. Larry?
And I would like to start out actually by asking people, how many people here had some contact with Bobby Kennedy, some of their own personal stories about him, anything? Anybody? Some? A few. So we'll hear those later on. What I would like to do is take you through in trying to introduce you to somebody who is one of the most familiar public figures out there and somebody about whom 100 books have been written. I would like to try to give you a slightly different take on who Bobby Kennedy was by taking you to three critical and defining moments in his life that I think suggest not just who he was, but the arc of how he was changing. And the first moment was 1957. And it was 1957 in the state of Wisconsin at an airport, a little airport in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And there was a big funeral going on this particular day, and it was a funeral of a very famous U.S. senator from Wisconsin named Joseph McCarthy. And Joe McCarthy was being buried in nearby Appleton, Wisconsin, and an enormous plane flies into the town of Green Bay, into the airport. And out of this plane get 19 U.S. senators and 7 congressmen and a whole passel of other dignitaries. And they do what dignitaries always do when they get out of big airplanes. They get into big black limousines, and they're whisked away to the funeral in nearby Appleton, Wisconsin. And after the airport goes quiet and it looks like nobody else is around, one thin, short, young congressional staffer named Robert Francis Kennedy gets out of that airplane. And the idea that he was there at all is a little bit counterintuitive, because obviously McCarthy was a conservative Republican and Bobby Kennedy is from a family that represented sort of iconic liberal Democrats. It was also counterintuitive because his big brother Jack said, "You will not go to that funeral." And Bobby did what younger brothers often do when big brothers give him advice. He listened very dutifully, and he proceeded to do the opposite. He showed up at that funeral, and he rides from the airport by hitching a ride to town in the kind of open convertible that the Kennedys loved, with a reporter from the nearby Madison, Wisconsin newspaper. He watched the funeral from up in the choir loft. At the graveside service, everybody who mattered was over here, and Bobby Kennedy was way over there because he didn't want to be seen with them. After the service, what happened was something that in today's world you can't imagine happening, but happened regularly back then, which is Bobby Kennedy went up to all the reporters who were covering the funeral, and as part of funeral coverage in those days of celebrities, you named everybody important who was there. And he said, "Would you mind not naming me?" And because he was an important political figure, and more importantly, because he was a Kennedy, they did just what he said, and he never showed up in any of the stories. Thankfully for me, one of the reporters who was there, the guy who actually gave him a ride to the funeral, is still alive 50 years later and described all of this. And I thought when I heard this guy's story that it said to me two things that were important about who the early Bobby Kennedy was at the beginning of his political career. Partly it said something very good about him. It said that 5 or 6 years earlier, when Joe McCarthy had given this young, mediocre law student a job, Bobby Kennedy appreciated that. He appreciated it partly because Joe McCarthy was an important person then, and partly because his dad had said, "You should go to work for Joe McCarthy." And Bobby Kennedy generally did what his dad said. Unlike what his brother said, the dad says, "You'll go to work for Joe McCarthy," and it made sense to him. It also was good because not many other people were offering him jobs, and because Joe McCarthy, if you remember back to the 1950s and in his pre-Senate censor days, Joe McCarthy was much in the style of another demagogue out there today that I won't name because this is a nonpartisan group. He was a very popular guy in America. Bobby Kennedy thought in those days that Joe McCarthy was the only one who was truly appreciating the threat that communism posed, not just from the distant Soviet Union, but behind the pillars of the State Department. And so Bobby Kennedy willingly went to work for Joe McCarthy. He stayed for 7.5 months. And years later, when Joe McCarthy was buried, the loyal Bobby Kennedy, no matter what it would look like to his brother Jack, the loyal Bobby Kennedy went to that funeral. And that was the side of him that remained the Irish, the Catholic, and the very loyal guy for the rest of his life. That was the way Bobby Kennedy behaved. And that's not a bad thing to say about somebody. The other side of Bobby Kennedy was the political spinmeister Bobby Kennedy, who would help get his brother elected to Congress, to the Senate, and most importantly, to the White House. And that Bobby Kennedy understood that 3 years later, Jack was going to be running for, and in Bobby's mind, Jack was going to win. Even at that early point in 1957, he was certain that Jack was going to win the presidency. And Bobby was not about to do anything to embarrass his brother Jack. So he went to the funeral because he was a loyalist, and he hid the fact that he went to the funeral because he was a Kennedy. That's Bobby Kennedy in 1957, and that is very much who this guy was. He was strong-minded, he was very loyal, he was determined about the things that he believed in. He was blind to the fact that his buddy, Joe McCarthy, in addition to taking a stand, which may have made sense back then against communism, left scattered in his wake lots of victims, and Bobby Kennedy didn't quite see that in those days. I want to flash forward to moment number two that I want to take you to, and that was a very different moment in Bobby Kennedy's life. It was November of 1963, and it was a particular day in November of 1963 that I bet, looking at the faces around the room, that if I asked you where you were and what you were thinking on that day, it was my generation, the baby boom generation's 9/11, where we remember what we were thinking and what we were doing. And what Bobby Kennedy was doing on that day, before he got a fateful phone call, was he was doing what he often did. He had gone into work that morning at the Justice Department and worked very hard. But he was a Kennedy, and he could have his limousine and his chauffeur take him home to his extraordinary estate called Hickory Hill, over the hill in McLean, Virginia, from the CIA, and he could go for a wonderful swim at his poolside, and he could have a great lunch. And he could change after lunch and be sitting, relaxing with his wife and a couple young staffers at poolside when the phone rang. And the phone at his swimming pool was not a normal swimming pool phone. It was a hotline to the White House, one of several hotlines that they had in the Hickory Hill estate. When that phone rang, it was generally not with good news. When that phone rang and the guy on the other end of the line was a man named J. Edgar Hoover, it was never good news. Ethel holds up the phone and says, "It's Hoover on the line for you," and Bobby knows something bad's about to be said. And what was said was, "Your brother has been shot." And about an hour, he says it, by the way, in a monotone that it was as if he was reporting the traffic in downtown Washington that day. An hour later, another phone call comes and it says, "Your brother is dead." In a moment, in an epiphany moment, Bobby Kennedy's life is transformed. Suddenly, it's not just his brother and his best friend and his boss that he has lost. It is his sense of purpose in life. This was a guy who was defined by his brother's career. He was defined by his sense of what public service meant. And suddenly, it is all pulled out from under him. And just a quick side note, in case he didn't get what had changed in his status in Washington as of that moment, J. Edgar Hoover would quickly remind him. One of the bones of contention, as you all know, the Attorney General is the boss of the FBI director, but nobody had bothered in all of his years of service to tell J. Edgar Hoover that. And we talked about a hotline from Hickory Hill to the White House. There was another hotline from the Attorney General's desk to what was intended to be the FBI director's desk. Hoover had always put that phone on his secretary, Mrs. Grundy's desk, because he was J. Edgar Hoover, and an attorney general, he might want to take the call, he might not, but he shouldn't have to answer the phone directly. He's the FBI director. Bobby Kennedy insisted, almost from day one of going to the attorney general's office, that that phone sit on Hoover's desk, not on his secretary's desk. So when he picked it up, he was assured that the FBI director was going to be the one who picked it up at the other end. The very day after his brother was assassinated, that phone went back on Mrs. Grundy's desk. And Hoover was sending a not very subtle signal, not just the signal that you're less important now, but the signal, I've got my own hotline directly to the White House to a guy named Lyndon Johnson, and you don't matter anymore. For the month after Jack Kennedy was shot, Bobby Kennedy was an extraordinary public figure. The Kennedy family, as you would imagine, was shattered. The one who, Joe Kennedy, who was the leader of the Klan, had had a stroke, but Joe Kennedy had already dubbed as his successor his son Bobby. He was actually the official executor of the estate, but more importantly, he was the leader of the Klan. Bobby Kennedy took seriously that leadership role, and he told his brother Ted, an hour after they heard that Jack was dead, you will go and tell Mom and Dad what's happened. He told his sister Eunice, you will go and arrange the funeral. Somebody had to do all these things, and Bobby was extraordinary. He somehow pulled it together to make everything happen within the family. He also, for those of you who remember that month of November 1963, the country was shattered. We had lost our new frontiersman. We had lost our young, promising president. Bobby Kennedy, for the next month, was America's mourner-in-chief. He was the one who showed up at every eulogy, at every funeral, at every tribute to his brother, and he gave the country a sense of reassurance. He gave Lyndon Johnson, whether Johnson would ever admit it or not, a sense of legitimacy. He was the one who said, we've lost my brother, and I may hate Lyndon Johnson, but it's important that we have a transition that makes sense in America. At the end of a month, something was happening to the country and to the family. The family was starting to go back to work and adjust to this new reality of Jack Kennedy being gone. The country was starting to adjust to the new reality that Lyndon Johnson, like him or not like him, was our new president. At the end of the month, when everybody else was pulling it together, Bobby Kennedy crashed. And he crashed in a way that I think any clinical psychologist who was looking at him back then would have said he was going through as serious a situational depression as you could have. How was it manifested? He would drive around in his convertible in the middle of winter, going nowhere in the middle of the night. He would show up at work and be totally focusless. This was a guy who would zero in as attorney general in any meeting he was ever at. He was the one who stayed most focused on just what they were trying to do, and he had no focus anymore. The only thing that pulled him out of his depression, do people remember, so this is 1963, Jack dies. We're talking now going into the summer and even the early fall of 1964. What did Bobby run for at that point? What office do you remember? Senator from where? From the state that everybody from Hillary Clinton to Bobby Kennedy, who has no real home or wants to find a state to run for senator. He had thought about running for senator from Massachusetts, but that would have presented a problem in having to take on a young guy named Ted Kennedy. He thought about running for senator from Virginia, which is where his estate was, but that would have meant taking on an icon of the Senate named Harry Byrd. So he did what everybody does. They look around state shop and decide that New York is the place that is best. And he had lived in New York for long enough as a child to call himself a New Yorker, which made sense to everybody other than somebody who knew what New York was like. And he was the consummate carpetbagger, but you could get away with it in New York. He runs for senator from there, but even at the beginning of his campaign for Senate, he was still in this depression. And the only thing that lifted him out of it was the horrific notion that occurred to him in about mid-October that he could actually be the first Kennedy to lose an election. And if you ever want to shake a Kennedy out of lethargy, you use the four-letter word lose. And that had its intended effect. And finally, he started to understand at that point, midway through the campaign, that New Yorkers and Americans generally liked him, not just because he was Jack Kennedy's kid brother and because he was sort of a sad figure who had lost three siblings already. It was that he was somebody important and interesting and passionate and lots of things on his own. The other thing that happened in this epiphany moment after his brother's death was, this was a guy, Bobby Kennedy, whose normal way, if he wanted to relax, was to go out and play a game of touch football that looked more like tackle football and that was about as unintellectual as you could get. Suddenly, post-assassination, people could find him with the door closed to his room reading Greek tragedies. reading Greek tragedies that Jackie Kennedy had suggested that he read, quoting from Aeschylus and lots of other wonderful Greeks, and most importantly, understanding, I think, for the first time in his life, that the whole Greek notion of hubris applied to the Kennedys as much as anybody in the world. That you could look like you had everything like they did, and you could perpetually be struck by tragedy. So I don't want to say that nobody ever starts as a banana and ends up as a grape. But we are all some balance. If I were to go around and interview everybody in this room, we are all some balance of tough and tender. And in Bobby Kennedy, the dial started skewed to the tough. And after his brother's assassination, very noticeably, the dial started skewing to the tender. So moment 157, McCarthy. Moment number two that really mattered, 1963, when he goes from being attorney general to being a guy who's got to figure out what he's going to do with the rest of his life. Moment number three is my favorite moment because by that time he had figured out what he wanted to do for the rest of his life, and it was what he wanted to do was something that I'm convinced, and nobody can prove me wrong because he's not around to do it, I'm convinced could have changed America. Moment number three was in 1968. And in 1968, you will all maybe remember that Bobby Kennedy jumped in after the New Hampshire primary, a bare 4 days after the New Hampshire primary, to challenge Lyndon Johnson for the Democratic nomination for president. He jumped in a way that convinced every journalist who was covering that campaign that their old label of Bobby Kennedy as being ruthless was right, because he came in on the wings of Eugene McCarthy's victory in New Hampshire over Lyndon Johnson. When you added in the Republican write-in votes, an unknown senator from Minnesota actually beat in the first presidential primary the sitting powerful president who had won by historic margins just 4 years before in 1964. Bobby Kennedy jumps into the race in a way that, as I say, looks like, in the words of a political commentator of the time who wrote a telegram to Ted Kennedy, this guy said, "What your brother did after the New Hampshire primary showed that St. Patrick hadn't driven all of the snakes out of Ireland." And he was right, and it looked that way. We know now that we have the benefit of history, and now that people like me can go out and sort of and use all the benefits of the internet and everything else, digging up every source on the thing, we now know that, in fact, 9 days before that primary, Bobby Kennedy had made the very definite decision that he was going to run in New Hampshire. And rather than being ruthless, it was ham-handed the way he jumped into that race, because he waited and wanted to give McCarthy, who had been fighting against LBJ in New Hampshire for a long time, he wanted to give him the open field there. He knew just how vulnerable Lyndon Johnson was. There was nobody who had better polling data and everything else, but Bobby Kennedy decided to wait and keep it quiet. He announces 4 days later, and he looks terrible. But the moment that I want to take you to is in April of 1968, and somebody very important to all of us was assassinated in April 1968. And he was assassinated at a moment when Bobby Kennedy was in the middle of campaigning in his first contested primary of 68. Anybody remember? So New Hampshire happens, and then Bobby Kennedy takes on not just Gene McCarthy, but a sitting governor who's running as a favorite son of what state? Do you remember?
Indiana.
Who said Indiana? Great. So Indiana. Do you remember who the governor was? So you would have won a real award if so the governor was a guy named Brannigan. Bobby's running against the two of them. And one night he's flying into Indianapolis for a big rally. And that's the night Martin Luther King is shot and killed. Bobby lands in Indianapolis and they tell him King is gone. The mayor, do you remember who the mayor of Indianapolis was then? So the mayor was a guy who became a very powerful U.S. senator named Richard Lugar, Dick Lugar. Dick Lugar says to Bobby, "You have a rally planned in the middle of the black community tonight, and you will not go to that rally. You won't go to that rally because I'm not sure you're going to come out alive, and I'm not sure that you won't set off a conflagration of some sort if you go in there." Bobby Kennedy did precisely what he did when Jack Kennedy gave him the advice. He listened, he said, "Interesting," and he said, "Goodbye, here I go to the rally." He drives in with his police escort to the edge of the black community. Then he tells the police, "You go away." He goes into the community. He jumps up on the back of a flatbed truck. He throws away his prepared notes, and for the next 5 minutes, he delivers what may have been the most pitch-perfect speech ever given in a racially charged situation. He goes into the community intending, he is telling most people in that audience for the first time that Martin Luther King has been killed. And you can listen to on YouTube to the speech, and you will hear gasps and people saying, oh no, and it can't be true. Bobby Kennedy goes into the community intending to embrace the community in the pain that they were feeling at the loss of Martin Luther King. But something magical happened over those 5 minutes. For the first time in his life, he talked about what it felt to lose his brother. And he couldn't even say the name Jack Kennedy at that moment. This was the closest he had ever come to talking about it, and he said, somebody important to me. And obviously everybody in the audience knew just what he was talking about. And by the end of his speech, he was saying, I know what it's like to feel anger. I know what it's like to want to strike out. And this is precisely the moment where we have to come together rather than become more divided. By the end, I say that he went into the ghetto intending to embrace people he was talking to. And by the end of his 5 minutes, the community that was listening to him wanted to embrace him for his loss. It was magic. And don't trust me. You should never trust somebody whose resume includes having been a longtime journalist. What you should trust are the facts of what happened in America that night. What happened in America the night of Martin Luther King's death was a lot of anger that had been seething in inner cities across America for understandable reasons erupted. And in more than 100 cities, there were riots that night. In the city of Washington, D.C., a good part of the black community was burned down that night. The one city of note with a sizable African-American population that did not riot that night San Francisco, now great. I don't honestly know what happened in San Francisco, but my guess is that it wasn't what happened in the city that I care about, which was Indianapolis. And Indianapolis didn't riot because of one thin, young presidential candidate named Robert Francis Kennedy. He was, from that night to the rest of his life, without any hyperbole, I can say that he was the singly most popular white man in black America. He was the one who, in his days of being relatively clueless on civil rights, which included the days when he started out as attorney general, and he was very slow to respond to the violence against the Freedom Riders when they got to places like Anniston, Alabama, and Birmingham, Alabama, and Montgomery, Alabama, and when they were trying to integrate Ole Miss, the University of Mississippi. Bobby Kennedy waited too long to insert federal forces, and he was only slowly understanding things that he should have known long before that. In those early clueless days, a guy who almost got killed because of Bobby Kennedy's slow response, who was a guy named Martin Luther King, who was in a church in Montgomery when rioters were attacking that church. Martin Luther King understood from the very beginning something that none of his young, less patient proteges understood. He told his young acolytes, people like Andrew Young, who went on to become the mayor of Atlanta, he said, there is within this guy, Bobby Kennedy, some good, and we've just got to be the ones to dig that good out of him and to realize it. It was poetry that, so this is early 1960s that he's saying that, poetry that 5 or 6 years later, at Martin Luther King's death, the white American politician who was most sensitive in responding to that was Bobby Kennedy. I tell you that story partly because this is the ending of our three moments, and it's the moment where I think Bobby Kennedy showed who he really was. But more importantly, I tell you that story because it has meaning today. And it has meaning today when, in the wake of Baton Rouge, in the wake of Dallas, Texas, in the wake of ongoing racial tension that reminds anybody with a long enough memory of what America was going through in 1968, lots of important public figures have been looking for the voice that Bobby Kennedy found in 1968. Hillary Clinton is looking for it, and I think she really means it when she says she's looking for it, but she sure as heck hasn't found it. Donald Trump is not looking for it. Barack Obama, He is looking for it and sort of found it in the 45-minute talk he gave at the funeral of the police officers in Dallas. He came closer than anybody else. But it took him 45 minutes, and he didn't touch what Bobby Kennedy said in the course of 5 minutes that night in Indianapolis. And I think, as I've suggested to you where we started out with Bobby Kennedy, he is no saint. And I'm not here to tell you we should worship Bobby Kennedy. What I am here to tell you is we can learn a whole lot from where Bobby Kennedy was when he was running for president in 1968. And that is where I hope we are. This is nonpartisan, right? Commonwealth Club. So I won't say how I hope we're going to get there, but I hope by the end of this campaign where we have found a leader who does a couple things. One is that we have found a leader who understands, in the way Bobby Kennedy understood in 1968, that you can actually unite the kind of blue-collar whites who were part of Bobby Kennedy's earliest coalition in the 1950s and who are the angry Trump whites of today, that you can actually find a way of uniting them with African Americans, with Hispanics, with Native Americans, with the Hillary Clinton kind of liberal and minority coalition of today. Bobby Kennedy offered the promise of building bridges. I'm not saying he would have gotten every vote had he been the nominee for president, but I'm saying he was finding a way to build bridges between the early world of Bobby Kennedy and the later world of Bobby Kennedy that we have not seen somebody do in the last 50 years. He had managed the most cynical people ever about what goes on in politics, and that was true in 1968 and it is true today, are the rhinoceros-hided political reporters who are out there every day covering candidates. Because they're watching Hillary Clinton say one thing when she's talking to group A over here and another thing when she's talking to group B. It's what politicians do. They have focus groups. They tailor their messages to whoever they're talking to. These reporters started out hating Bobby Kennedy in 1968 because of the way he jumped into the race. By the end of the race, they thought something very different. They watched him go into a black community and a white community and deliver precisely the same speech. And he managed in both communities to find exactly the things that neither wanted to hear. He told both communities, "We need number one safe streets. No rioting, violence will not be tolerated." But at the same time, he said, the only way we get safe streets is to have racial justice. Telling everybody just the opposite of what they wanted to hear. That is the opposite of being a demagogue, and it is the opposite of what most politicians spend their lives doing with their speeches. I want to just tell you really quickly about one particular reporter who to me was a metaphor for the rest of the press corps and for America as a whole, watching Bobby Kennedy in 1968. It was one of the toughest reporters ever to cover politics, a guy named Richard Harwood of the Washington Post. He was an ex-Marine. His first experience with Bobby Kennedy, when Ben Bradley of the Washington Post assigned him to cover the campaign, his first experience was to go out and play touch football with him, and he came back, Harwood came back with a bloody nose, and he was convinced that Bobby Kennedy played dirty in politics and in football. That was precisely why Ben Bradley had appointed him to cover this campaign. He said, "You will not fall in love with the Kennedys." By the end of the campaign, Harwood had watched Bobby do that thing of telling audiences the opposite of what they wanted to hear, that he, and along with most of the rest of the press corps, realized that here was a man who was described by the word that you very seldom hear associated with politicians. Here was a man who was authentic. He was for real. He was willing to tell people the hard truth that they needed to hear. By the end of the campaign, Richard Harwood went to Ben Bradley, his boss, and said, "You got to take me off the campaign. I've fallen in love with a candidate." Now, Ben Bradley, who had fallen in love with the Kennedys 10 years before, said, "No way, you're staying on the campaign." The most eloquent of all the eulogies written for Bobby Kennedy after he died were written by Richard Harwood. It was a magic. Something was going on then. After lots of years of putting up with this brash young guy who was legitimately ruthless, by the end, Bobby Kennedy was almost, when we look back at him now, too good to be believed because he was very much a politician. So I want to end by saying to you that I have all kinds of self-serving reasons why I would like you to revisit 1968 and Bobby Kennedy's life, because I've written a book about him and whatever. But I think legitimately, as much as I could ever say legitimately, that there is a period in history that informs where we are today. What happened 50 years ago, America was riven by racial strife. America was riven by overseas anxiety, terrorism now, then it was Vietnam. We were a country as divided as we were. And what we need to look for, and what I think we can take inspiration from Bobby Kennedy's life as, is somebody who can bring us together. Because I'm convinced that if a politician were to stand up and tell us the hard truths and were to be honest with us, as cynical as we are today, we were every bit as cynical in 1968 as we showed ultimately in electing Richard Nixon president. We want to hear that voice today, and Bobby gave it to us. And what I would like to do now is stop talking, and George or anybody, if people have stories or questions or whatever, he'll take over. Thank you.
I'd like to remind our audiences online and radio that they're listening to Larry Tye, the author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. It's time for questions and answers. One of the things that is very interesting about the Kennedy family is this combination between their idealism and their ruthless practicality. Say the connections with mafia leaders, as they say, and other kinds of relationships that Jack had and so on. So. Where do you find that? I mean, do you think that Bobby went beyond what Jack was doing, or do you think that Bobby came a little bit closer to the way Jack thought about things?
So I think Rose Kennedy, everybody remembers Rose Kennedy, the great matriarch of the Kennedy family who lived to be 203. And the Rose Kennedy was a devout Catholic, and Rose Kennedy dreamed that one of her boys would go into the priesthood. And had they been priests, Jack Kennedy would have been the Pope, because that was who Jack Kennedy was. He liked to lead, he liked to be above the fray, he liked to sort of be up here. Bobby Kennedy would have been a parish priest, and he was the grassroots guy who learned from experiencing. When he experienced things, he got down. His favorite people to campaign in terms of the audience that he wanted to reach were actually young children who he obviously knew didn't vote. But he would campaign with them at eye level of children. He told stories that made sense to kids. He was a guy who related at a very different level than Jack did, and he would have been an exceedingly different president. He would have been passionate in a way that Jack Kennedy was reserved and contained. He would have been less intellectual, because I don't think he was as smart, book smart, as Jack was, but he told stories from the heart. Jack Kennedy, when you asked him about any tough issue, what are you going to do about a real civil rights bill? What are you going to do about firing that crazy J. Edgar Hoover? His answer to everything was, I'm going to do all of that in 1964 when I'm reelected. Bobby Kennedy wouldn't have waited 5 minutes after he was elected, because he was impatient, and he was so much more prepared to be president than Jack Kennedy was. Bobby Kennedy served, we call now in books and in everything else, Ted Kennedy, who was an iconic figure in my native Massachusetts. We call him the Lion of the Senate. The truth is, Ted Kennedy spent his 50 years in the Senate trying to be Bobby. He was never trying to be Jack, because Jack wasn't a very good senator, and Jack didn't do much. Jack was running for president from the day he was elected to Congress. Bobby Kennedy, I don't know how to say it any more than to say Bobby Kennedy to me was the most interesting of the Kennedy family, and the one who today resonates in a way, and the one who Jack Kennedy got for 3 years to be president. Bobby Kennedy never got to hold any power, and yet 50 years later, people still worship Bobby Kennedy, and he is one of the only people in American history, along with Martin Luther King, who never served as president, and yet if I were to tell you not Bobby Kennedy, if I were to refer to him as RFK, you would know him by his initials, and for a non-president, that is unheard of.
I'd like to go back to your comments about racial strife in 1968, racial strife and divide in 2016. You inferred, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I'd like you to expand on why you believe this, that we have a better chance of helping some of this racial divide by electing a white president than an African-American president, which we've had for 7.5 years, and only touched on it for the last bit of a 45-minute speech. So if you could.
So that's a great question. And if I implied that, I only partly meant to imply that. I wasn't talking about Barack Obama's race and whether. I was saying that for a lot of reasons, I think. So Barack Obama, you know who Barack Obama's role model was when he became president? More than any single individual out there, anybody know? And I'm saying this partly because it's self-serving, but it also happens to be true, was Bobby Kennedy. And the Bill Clinton's role model was Jack Kennedy. Hillary's role model, and even more Barack Obama's, is Bobby Kennedy. He gave one of his most moving speeches as president talking about Bobby Kennedy and all he had done. And what I want to say is, first of all, almost exactly 40 years to the day before Barack Obama was elected president, Bobby Kennedy said, "We will have in 40 years a black president." Now, if any white politician thought that back then, I doubt it, but if any white politician thought that back then, there were no points to be made by saying that. And Bobby Kennedy not only thought it, he said it, and he was exactly right. He was prescient in a lot of things, but in terms of him versus Obama, I will tell you something. So I think Obama has been, in many ways, a magnificent president. And in talking about racial issues, in doing a lot of things about one of the causes that matters to blacks and whites and everybody, which is my issue that I spent my time as a journalist on, which is healthcare, and he gave us, you know, something presidents have been trying to do for half a century. But what Barack Obama didn't have, and what Jack Kennedy didn't have, was Bobby Kennedy's how not just to believe passionately in something, but how to get it done. And I think Barack Obama's, if his legacy is one of brilliance in oratory and in doing, having a couple magnificent achievements, his deficit will be that he wasn't the Lyndon Johnson in terms of knowing how to get Congress to work his will, and he wasn't the Bobby Kennedy. And Bobby Kennedy was, in the words of one of my favorite political analysts, a guy named Mark Shields, who was on PBS. Mark Shields says, "We've spent 50 years looking for the tough liberal, or if you prefer, the tender conservative that Bobby Kennedy represented." Now, it's easy because Bobby isn't around and because he never was president for me to say he could have done anything. He could have made the sky bluer, and he could have cleaned up the oceans, and he could have done anything. But I do believe that the biggest deficit of Barack Obama was Bobby Kennedy's biggest strength, was knowing from day one how to bang heads together and how to make things work in a way. He was not the orator that Obama is, but... And what I wonder is, if we were behind closed doors and I was saying that to Barack Obama about his political mentor, my guess is he would say, yeah, I wish I had more of those kinds of particular skills of Bobby Kennedy's.
Yeah, you know, I think we have to realize that Bobby Kennedy was very gifted. He had all these resources. And it was his dad's generation that he drew from. Most people don't do that when they run for president. 50 years from 1968, I'm working on a book looking at San Francisco's state in terms of the legacy of ethnic studies. And some of the research I'm coming across has to do with something that comes out of the Kennedy family and also Reverend King's family, and that is the role of the communities of faith. When I'm digging through the archives in the Archdiocese of San Francisco, the faith communities, whether they be Christian, Muslim, Jewish, Buddhist, were very involved. I mean, that's why we didn't blow up like Berkeley, for example. And so when you talk about, well, who now in D.C. might have that kind of affiliation that Bobby Kennedy does, you have to have somebody that's morally grounded and has real field experience. I mean, because he went off to the farm workers. And the person that comes to mind is vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine. He's also got that Irish Catholic background. And so I wish you could address that in terms of because I think we're beyond liberal and conservative with the millennials coming in and the global atmosphere. I mean, this is really baby boomer stuff. We got to go beyond that. So what do you see in that? And also the other one has not just the role of the faith communities, because when you go to Southeast Asia and you see how forgiving the Cambodians and Thai are of what we did to those people, That gives us a lot of lessons. But the other one is the role of the media and how they have shaped what's happened in terms of the dumbing down of the United States people and their ability to talk about history and civics. Thank you.
Good. So that's a lot, and I'm going to try to remember all of that when I... So I think the question about the role of faith, one of the things that I think... So faith has been given a bad name by a lot of what politicians do in exploiting their religion as a way of sort of trying to win votes. I can't quite figure out what Donald Trump's faith is, because when he talks to evangelicals, he's maybe an evangelical. I don't know what he is. But I think that in Bobby Kennedy's life, unlike any of the other Kennedys of his generation, except for maybe Eunice, faith was everything. Faith was defining. He took his Catholic teachings really seriously. He was disdainful of the hierarchy of his church and supportive of its morality and its principles. And that was in keeping with the faith communities that were doing wonderful work in civil rights. It was in keeping with lots of things. And I think that and it doesn't have to be just about his time. It could be about our time and understanding that we look to religion not for political advantage, but for moral guidance. In the same way, I mean, what he was doing, in fact, it was a different faith, but it was really similar to what Martin Luther King was doing and what the civil rights movement growing out of faith. And there was, I got to tell you, one of the funniest but not funniest lines from the 1960 campaign was, do you know how Bobby Kennedy won for Jack Kennedy, the presidency in 1960? There are two wonderfully poetic stories that have grown out of that campaign, and I'm not going to forget the other half of your question, but I just want to tell this really quickly. That so the stories that grew out of 1960, the great myths, are that Jack Kennedy won the presidency either because he didn't have a 5 o'clock shadow when they went and debated on television. He looked better than Richard Nixon, and he didn't have a 5 o'clock shadow, and he did look better, and it didn't take much then, especially since Nixon was coming out of the hospital, to look better. But that's not what won it for Bobby Kennedy. The other great story is that Jack Kennedy won because he had lots of votes from the graveyards of Chicago gathered by Mayor Daley, and that it was the mafia or the Democrats or whomever that won it for him. That isn't what won it for him. What won it for him was Martin Luther King Jr. was arrested in Atlanta for some trumped-up driving charge shortly before the 1960 election. And as Dwight Eisenhower would later say, it was two phone calls that changed that election. The first phone call was Jack Kennedy making a classic Jack Kennedy phone call to Coretta King, saying, I feel badly that Martin was elected. Not I'm going to do anything about it, but I feel badly. And she was incredibly grateful. And say it again, I'm sorry.
Arrested.
That he was arrested. And Jack felt badly about it, but Coretta King needed more than that. And Martin Luther King had not just been arrested and jailed, he had been sent to a state prison and to a work farm. And when you were a civil rights leader in that era, sent to a work farm in the state of Georgia, whether you would survive that was very doubtful. And she thought he was going to be killed. The real phone call, and the phone call we didn't find out all the details about until about 30 or 40 years later, was a phone call that Bobby Kennedy made. Any lawyers in this room? Great. So you don't have to be a lawyer to understand what I'm about to say, but Bobby Kennedy made a phone call very quietly to the sentencing judge in Atlanta. Now, Bobby Kennedy's a lawyer, and he's calling a judge ex parte, sort of off the screen. Ethical? Absolutely not. Effective? Absolutely. He said, can you let Martin Luther King out of jail? And the judge says, that's no problem. The charges aren't real. Bobby Kennedy said, to express our thanks, if we're elected to the White House, or he may have said when we're elected, if you'd ever like to come and visit the White House, which the judge ended up doing years later, we'd be glad that you did it. So after that, something magical happened. First of all, Martin Luther King, when he was let out of jail and lots of reporters were around, he said, I'd just like to thank Jack Kennedy. And he didn't say Bobby. I'd like to thank Jack Kennedy for whatever role he played in this. Martin Luther King's father, and here's where I get to the faith question, Reverend Martin Luther King Sr., said something that was quite extraordinary. He said, even though he's a Catholic, I'm going to put all my votes in a suitcase and take them down and cast them for Jack Kennedy. The Sunday before the election, in every African-American church in America, little pamphlets that they called blue bombs, because they were blue pamphlets, went out saying, essentially, you have two choices on Tuesday, Election Day. You can vote for the candidate without a heart, Richard Nixon, or you can vote with Jack Kennedy, the candidate who has a heart. The smartest analyst of politics back then, who every 4 years would write a great book called The Making of the President, was a guy named Theodore White. And Theodore White says what changed that election result in 1960 was the African-American vote in about five critical states. Michigan, maybe Ohio, whatever, maybe Illinois. He said that all Richard Nixon had to do was get the percent of the vote that Dwight Eisenhower had gotten 4 years before, and we will all remember that the Republicans back then were the party of Lincoln and the party that blacks generally voted for. That started to change in 1960 with Jack Kennedy. The vote shifted just enough in the African-American community to give Jack Kennedy a victory, and that was quite extraordinary in my mind. But getting back to the question of faith, so the answer on Bobby Kennedy was faith was everything with him, and that helped define everything. The second half of your question was?
About the media.
Oh, right, the media. So honestly, it's easy to say that the media today is worse or more superficial. The media was always superficial. Back then, in a non-instantaneous news cycle, they had a little more time to think things through. But if you were to ask Richard Harwood, the reporter I was telling you about, he was filing three stories a day, and he didn't have a whole lot of time to be thoughtful. The media then and today shares a couple characteristics which I think are relevant. One is they're still overworked, they are still underpaid, and this is tough for anybody to believe, but I can tell you, having been a reporter most of my life, most of them still want to do the right thing, and they want to have a candidate that they can believe in, and they want to believe that somebody is authentic. And they still have the best, we're on the radio but not controlled by the FCC, or we are here. Right. Great. So they have the best bullshit meter of anybody following elections. And today, if they found a candidate that they thought was for real, and I agree with you that Tim Kaine comes pretty close to that in lots of ways, they would be out there shouting, this candidate is for real, because it would be counterintuitive. Nobody would believe them originally, but they want it, and so the media hasn't changed much, and they can still be a force for good, or they can be a parroting force.
As you mentioned, the 60s were a decade of political assassinations. Would you care to share your thoughts on the forces that led to that and perhaps the groups involved?
Yes. So I want to start out with a disclaimer. I don't pretend to have any answers in terms of what happened on who assassinated Jack Kennedy or Bobby Kennedy. And I honestly, I steered away from that for a couple reasons. One is because I wouldn't be arrogant enough to say, you want to say you can deliver and really deliver. And I would never know enough to be able to say that. More importantly, most of the people who could answer that definitively are dead now, 50 years later. But what I can say and what I think matters about Bobby Kennedy in terms of Jack Kennedy's assassination is I think Bobby Kennedy went to his grave with an overwhelming sense of guilt. It was the guilt of wondering, was it what he did in chasing down organized crime in a way that no attorney general had ever done? Was that something that somehow set off a set of circumstances that killed his brother? Was it what he did in terms of going after Jimmy Hoffa, according to Bobby Kennedy, the corrupt leader of the Teamsters Union, who was very powerful and had a lot of very nasty friends? Was it what he did in waging for an entire year before the Cuban Missile Crisis a secret war called Operation Mongoose against Fidel Castro, and that included trying to assassinate Fidel Castro? Was that somehow something that went horribly awry and ended up in getting his brother killed? Bobby Kennedy didn't pretend to have the answers to any of that, but I think every night he had a little more trouble than he would otherwise have had in going to sleep, because he always said, after Jack's assassination, it should have been me. And I think he thought that he set off a hornet's nest somewhere, and he was convinced, I'm convinced, that the only way he was going to get the definitive answer was to be the President of the United States and have the true control over the investigation, and that never happened.
Two questions. One is, how old would he be today? And second, what did he do to get out of his deep depression?
The first question was, how would he be?
How old would he be today?
Oh, so he would have turned 90 in November, which I don't know about you, but makes me feel ancient. And this is the cover of my book. And this shows Bobby Kennedy at age 42. And in my mind, this is how old Bobby Kennedy, I may be 102, but Bobby Kennedy will always be this incredibly young-looking, almost teenage-looking guy. So he would be quite old today. And the second part was?
What would he do on a daily basis to get out of his depression?
So what he did in a daily basis. So his was not, in my mind, and I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, his was not, in my mind, a chemical depression. It was not something he was going to be with. It was a situational depression. And what he did was change his situation. And he became that more tender guy. He had a sense of purpose by being a senator from New York. He had a family that was growing to be larger eventually than his parents' family, which meant having 11 kids. And he had too much to re-engage him with the world to stay mired in the depression that he had found himself in. So his circumstances changed.
Thank you for your excellent talk. I want to ask you about the subtitle of your book, which is The Making of a Liberal Icon. Let me say I have not read the book, although I do intend to do so. So in the particularly in the late 1960s, a lot of the political tension might be what you call between liberals and radicals, with particularly people in the anti-war movement feeling that it was liberals that had brought us that war. Jack Kennedy and Bob Kennedy, much earlier, in the early 1960s. Obviously, Robert Kennedy had changed his views on the war and was evolving more and more. Do you think, had he lived, he would have evolved out of the liberal camp and in the tensions of that time?
Yes. So to be honest, and you can't repeat this to my publisher, liberal was probably a misnomer for what he was, because Bobby Kennedy was some extraordinary combination of Niccolo Machiavelli and Che Guevara. He was partly a very much mainstream, get-it-done, practical politician, and he was turning into a revolutionary. He was so much more left, or whatever word you want to use, than his brother Jack was. I would use the word brave and passionate and impatient. And that's not to take anything away from Jack Kennedy. They were, in a sense, of two different generations. Jack Kennedy was solidly part of the World War II generation, and Bobby Kennedy, who had enlisted in the Naval Reserve, made it to the Caribbean, and his injury came from, I can't remember, I'd have to go look it up in the book, whether he got in a fight with somebody or whether he fell down, but that was the injury he sustained during the war. And he was of the generation that was too young to have gone to war, but have thought, sort of spent their life thinking that they should have been making that sacrifice. He was a really different guy than his brother, and he was so interesting because he was not conventional anything, and certainly not a conventional liberal.
Thank you. I have two questions. You mentioned that Obama and Hillary's role model was Bobby Kennedy's, and who was Bobby Kennedy's role model?
Great question. And terrible answer, because his role models were a crazy collection of people ranging from Herbert Hoover, who I think he liked because his father liked Herbert Hoover and because Herbert Hoover once gave him a job. His role model was his father. And his father had, I could spend an entire day telling you just the bad things about his father, and I could spend another day telling you the good things. And Bobby adored his father and spent all of his childhood, and I think the rest of his life, trying to live up to the standard. His father called him the runt of the litter, partly because he was the smallest, partly because he was a middle child, and his father thought he was going to amount to nothing. And his father ended up convinced that Bobby was the one who was going to get the most done of anybody. And his other role model, and my favorite of his role models, and I've got a whole list of them in the book, but was Emerson. And Bobby believed in that sense of community. He believed in the transcendentalists. He would have said Thoreau as well. I mean, he believed that you have to, on the one hand, empower local communities. And there was a whole movement back then of vesting control of everything from the schools to anti-poverty programs in local communities. And that was a movement that started out with Bobby Kennedy. And what Bobby Kennedy did in the biggest ghetto in America, he intended to use that as a model for how to transform ghettos, and that was a community in Brooklyn called Bedford-Stuyvesant. And Bobby Kennedy understood that you, on the one hand, bring in great community programs, and on the other hand, you bring in IBM and private enterprise. And he was half communitarian. He was half taking ideas from Republicans that worked. He took ideas from radical Democrats. He was He was out there, and again, he's not a saint, but he was just doing the logical thing. It's smart. You borrow ideas from wherever the heck you can find them if they can work. So he didn't want to be labeled. Get it done. He was the most get it done kind of politician of his generation, and that was the, he just offered so much promise. And he offered it here in the state of California on the night that he died, because he showed that night. Go back and look at the vote totals, and nobody, and I mean nobody ever, has gotten in the Mexican community, Mexican-American community, as close to 100% of the vote as Bobby Kennedy did, because he was the only politician in America who would have ever dreamed of coming and sitting with Cesar Chavez when he was having his hunger strikes. When the two of them first met, they both were eloquent, inarticulate men, and they didn't need words, and they understood one another almost from moment one. There was a young aide of Bobby Kennedy's named Peter Edelman who was there when the two of them met, and there was magic that happened, and they got one another, and Cesar Chavez called a moratorium on his ongoing strikes the night of the California primary, because he wanted everybody out there working for Bobby Kennedy. That was more important to him than working for getting a good contract, because he knew that this was the one politician who wouldn't forget Mexican Americans if he were elected president. He was just, he had become something really special, and the idea that he was gunned down on the night of his biggest political victory, when the next day he was about to go to the city of Chicago, and Mayor Richard Daley, according to his son, was going to endorse Bobby Kennedy for president and hopefully bring with him the political establishment that had been for Hubert Humphrey. And if he had ever been the nominee, I want to promise you one thing. And that thing, I can't say that he would have won, but I think he would have won. But I can promise you that nobody in America knew Richard Nixon's vulnerabilities than the guy who 8 years before had won a campaign against Richard Nixon. And Richard Nixon went to his grave with the biggest fear that he ever had was that he was going to lose twice for the presidency against a guy named Kennedy. And I think it would have happened.
Thank you. My second question is, can you comment or make insights about Bobby Kennedy's kids in terms of why have they or have not they picked up Bobby's mantle?
So they have tried. Most of them have at least tried to do that. And I wrote this book in part because I went to high school with the most tragic of Bobby Kennedy's kids, a guy named David Kennedy, who the night that Bobby was shot at the Ambassador Hotel, all the younger kids had been put to sleep. And David Kennedy was in the hotel bungalow watching his father's victory speech on television. He watched as his father went into the kitchen, and he watched as somebody came back and announced to the television audience, Bobby Kennedy has been shot. I didn't know that this guy existed, the nanny who was there that night taking care of the kids. And the nanny described to me in a phone conversation in the last 2 weeks how he walked around the hotel repeatedly that night with David Kennedy telling him, everything's going to be all right. Your father's been shot, but he's alive and everything's going to be all right. And David Kennedy repeatedly said to him, no, Uncle Jack was shot, and when you're shot, you die. David Kennedy, years later, never recovered. David Kennedy had been the tenderest of his kids to start with. David Kennedy, 20 years later, died of a drug overdose in a hotel in Palm Beach, Florida, in a tragedy that I think was set off that night by losing his father. Bobby Kennedy had been the runt of his litter. David was the runt of Bobby's litter. They related as father and son. Earlier that day, the day of the California primary, Bobby Kennedy had been out swimming outside of L.A. at a movie producer's house and had rescued David, who, if Bobby hadn't been there, would have drowned. And they had something magical going on. And later that night, the idea that David saw live on television the death of his father was just...
All right. There's time for one more question. If somebody has one, they can come by. In the meantime, I'll tell one story about our family's connection with the Kennedys. My father was the mayor of Kenosha, Wisconsin, during the Wisconsin primaries in 1960. I was a friend of Mayor Daley's from Chicago and so on, and and I'm one of 12 kids. It's the same Catholic Irish background. And I have 45 first cousins. One of them was older, and he was already a young lawyer. And he was one of the people that interviewed Kennedy in Milwaukee for his, you know, big press conference in Wisconsin before the primary. And he kept asking, you know, Kennedy, what are you going to do about Catholicism? What are you going to do about the Pope? Everybody wants to know, are you going to listen to the Pope? And Kennedy just would avoid the issue. And the third time that he asked, the one of the Kennedy men was up in the newsroom. And also my cousin's son, who was 5 years old, was up in the newsroom. And the reporter said, who is that bastard asking those questions? And my 5-year-old relative said, it's my dad.
So can I say one?
My cousin really took credit for that because 3 weeks later, Kennedy made the announcement about the whole thing. He told him, you know, he was doing it. I was setting it up for you to make this decision because you need to say this.
So yeah. That's brilliant. And the famous speech that Jack Kennedy delivered in 1960 on his Catholicism, which sort of defanged the issue, was scripted, as we would expect, like everything important in that campaign, by Bobby Kennedy. But I would like to just say, as the last thing I say to you today, the young woman who asked the last question about what is the rest of the Kennedy family doing, a lot of people, including a lot of people in Massachusetts, think that the Kennedy reign as America's first family is over and that it's just that the fruit of the Kennedy tree gets less interesting over the years and that it's gone. And I want to tell you it's not gone. And the politician named Kennedy, who is most like Bobby Kennedy, is a young congressman from Massachusetts named Joseph P. Kennedy III. He is as smart, as sensitive, he is everything that his grandfather was. Now, whether he goes anywhere or not depends on a lot of things, but you can be assured that he's going to go somewhere in Massachusetts because he's smart and his name is Kennedy. And don't give up on the Kennedy first family notion. We may have another generation at some point that comes along. And thank you.
Thank you. I come from you 3-4 days a week. And so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 115th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.